Today on the 21st, we're talking poetry, politics, and our planet. The poet laureate of the United States, Juan Felipe Herrera, talks to us about his Chicano roots, immigrants today, and how all of these stories inform his work.
So many days and we didn't even know where we were headed. I know where we're going, where we always go, to some detention center, to some fingerprinting hall or cube.
Later, a new IMAX movie walks us through the Milky Way like we've never seen it before.
Aboard the International Space Station, a crew of astronauts from around the globe capture the wonders of our world.
We talk to the team of Illinois scientists that Hollywood turns to bring the universe to the big screen. That's all this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. We like the number 21 here, especially because Juan Felipe Herrera is the 21st poet laureate of the modern era of the United States. He's in the middle of his second term, holding the nation's highest honorary poetry position. Before that, he was also the poet laureate of California. Herrera is America's first Latino poet laureate. He's also a performance artist and an activist. And he's in Urbana because he was doing a book signing at the University of Illinois last night for his latest work, Notes on the Assemblage. And he's in studio with us now. Welcome to the 21st, Juan. It's great to have you here.
Thank you so much.
I should say the modern era, right? Because actually, if we add up all the numbers, there's been, you're the 51st poet laureate if we count the old era and the modern era.
Sure. You know, there's always a first in there. So it sounds like.
And you're a lot of firsts. We'll get to that in a minute.
Okay.
And I was going to ask you, actually, I don't know if you noticed all of the farmland on your drive down here and how much that reminded you at all of your childhood.
There's a lot of farmland, a lot of green, the color green. I love the color green. And it does, you know, even though my childhood was many years ago, it doesn't go away and things continue. You know, there's a lot of farm workers. And when we hang out, you know, we're still the same. You know, we're still going through the same kind of struggles and the same beauty also.
And I wanted to ask you about your family and your parents, because we're taking part on the 21st. It's a project called Redream, and it's a collection of public media stations that are talking about how the American dream has changed. And as part of that, we're actually doing an event next month at the Rantoul Multicultural Community Center, where we're asking people to share their immigrant stories of why their family came to the U.S. So I wanted to ask you not just why your family came, but what was your parents' dream of when they came here?
Well, you know, dream is a good word, and I like that. I like that word. I believe in that word. At the same time, you know, it was more of it was part a great adventure. It was also part a big part. It was moving out of almost complete what's called poverty, even though I see my parents as pioneers. So it was a time of pioneering. It was also a time of zero resources. So it's moving into where there could be more resources and being a pioneer to open new horizons and new roads for the children and the family and to reconnect with established family networks. It's not like we never were in California or we were never in the United States. This is Mexican land and Mexican Indian land. So, and it continues to be. Things have changed, of course. So it's there's a lot of other things going on. But indeed, there's also a dream involved that hopefully things will get better and change.
And that was your parents' dream when they relocated here?
That was my parents, part of my parents' experience. My father came here in the late 1890s. He was born in 1882. And my mother came from Mexico City and right after the Mexican Revolution. So, you know, before the Mexican Revolution, before the trembling and disassemblage of Mexico into a better place, and also after the Mexican Revolution and the great excitement and turmoil, also suffering, excitement, turmoil, and blood and happiness, all those things mixed together. You get on a train or you get on a bus or by horseback or you walk from Mexico City all the way to Juarez, so the borderline, and then somehow you get across and get to El Paso, where it's a different arrangement, and dreams are possible. But, of course, they can only go so far sometimes, and we need more social action to make things happen.
I want to talk to you about that, about how you think the dream has changed. But I wanted to ask you about that background. I wanted to go back to you saying you love the color green. When your parents came here, I wonder if we could talk about sort of just your earliest memories of green and farmland and working. If it was, I wonder what those stories were like.
Well, you know, it was being immersed in change and being immersed in being in my father's early 40s army truck that he drove, in a giant army truck, him and my mother and myself, and stopping here and there for them to work in various, fields, and whether it was grapes or drying peaches into dry peaches.
And you remember that?
I remember the fields and colors and the landscapes. And the rest is storytelling that my mother would tell me, or just see my father take off with his implements, his grape-picking knives, which are sharp, curled, eagle-like clawed knives.
Okay.
And so part of it is a kind of visual experience in our one-room trailer. And the other is through stories, and the other one is just visual, being in the flow of migrant action from ranch to ranch and little town to little town and being on the roads.
Well, there must have been so much community involved with that as well, though. Was there?
There's community once you get to the actual work site. But, you know, I only remember one occasion. What I remember are the people themselves, a few people that my father and mother, talked to and hung out with, or that came to the trailer. My mother healing the women with certain oils, visiting their little trailer, like across the yard, we would say. But so she would visit and provide, massage and healing, activities for them because they were in pain, young women. And then meeting people on occasion in the mountains where my father worked too, in Southern California, and farm workers that would, after a week of work, maybe on a Saturday, they would gather in a certain nook in the mountain and have a little fiesta, but only campesinos, only farm workers would be there, and small sweet flour tortillas. And kind of hanging out and talking and having these the food like that.
Mm. I'm speaking with Juan Felipe Herrera. He's the Poet Laureate of the United States. And as you were talking about your childhood, I think your poetry carries a lot of visual observations of hard labor. And I wonder if we can talk about that a little bit. What your personal experience with that was, or how much of it was just observation as well?
Well, you're right. I grew up as an observer and a listener, because when you're moving in the migrant trail, it's a lot of observation. It's kind of hyper observation because it's a new place, and you're moving to a new place. You're leaving a almost familiar place, and you look back and you see little families and a little doggy that I made a friend with, called Rowdy, a little black and white hound. He was trying to catch my father's trailer, and he was going.
And you had to leave him.
I needed to leave him. He wasn't mine, but we were buddies. So those are some visual moments. And then on that road, just in front of you, nothing on it, just dirt or a one-lane highway and the open land on the side. There was not much. California wasn't like the California now. And the California now wasn't like the California then. It was open.
How is it different?
Oh, it's just totally totally congested.
So urban now.
It's just totally urban. It's the whole Crescent City, North Califas or Eureka or Ukiah, or further up, all the way down to San Diego, San Isidro.
And the past couple of years, it's green. Also, I would imagine with the drought.
The green is mostly gone. The green is in the hope that people still have.
Mm. I wanted to go back to one of your older books, and I think people always use the term prolific with you because you've written so many different things. Do you have a number? I feel like everyone says dozens because
it's around 30.
They're about 30.
Around 30, yes.
I wanted to ask you about 187 reasons Mexicanos can't cross the border because you use this term outlaw and brown in the U.S. And I wanted to, before we get to those reasons, I wanted to ask, first of all, describe what you mean if you're calling yourself an outlaw, that term.
Well, that term's come up before. I think it could be in the introduction by Stephen Kessler. Brown, of course, of course
sure.
I am brown, but different shades of brown also.
Yeah, me too. I'm another shade of brown, right.
I don't know, sometimes I'm kind of green brown, Sometimes I'm kind of light brown, and sometimes I'm kind of dark brown. So I don't even know what the, you know, dark means anymore. And brown is good. You know, brown, you know, we're all brown. You know, we all get kissed by the sun. So so I don't think I've used the word outlaw.
Mm, okay.
But it's all right. You know, being on the outside looking in, I have definitely experienced that. Being on the outside looking in, even today, you know, and these days, even as you know, even now in my life, on many occasions, I still feel outside of the center of things.
Well, and as you say, as a poet, you're also an observer. I wonder if you yes. can apply your observation skills to this current political climate and to the presidential election, and to when we hear presidential candidates like Donald Trump saying, you know, they're bringing drugs, they're bringing crimes, they're rapists, describing Mexicans coming across the border. I mean, how do you experience that?
Well, you know, I don't have any comments on the campaign or Trump. However, these are not new statements. And in my poetry, and as it is in all of Latino poetry, you'll find these concerns. You're going back as far as you want to go back in time, whether it's in the 30s, like in the Juarez poets, like Roberto Quintana, writing about the patron, the boss, and the quote-unquote peasant, and having a dialogue in one of his poems. And these have always been issues of power and culture. And I dedicated my whole life on writing about these kind of things, you know. Being scapegoats, you know.
It's an interesting observation, though, that this is not a new conversation.
It's not a new conversation. I think for people of color and for people in the working class, scapegoatism, and we can use that word, is nothing new. And our working class citizenry in the United States works very hard and does all the jobs no one else wants. So we actually, in many ways, are the fuel of the agricultural business.
And when you say that, when you talk about working class conditions, I wanted to mention something to you as we're thinking about this area also. We have partners at WILL who investigate Midwest, and they actually went through inspection reports for 8 different migrant worker settlements throughout the region, and they found that workers were living in, I'm going to use a quote, blighted facilities, roaches, missing fire detectors, inadequate lighting and plumbing. I wonder, as you're thinking about 2016 and looking at these conditions, how you think that compares to how things have been in the past, and if you think things have changed.
Well, you know, there's a lot of changes. You know, things don't stay the same. And we do have the United Farm Workers Union. And a lot of the students and young people, the Dreamers, for example, we mentioned the term dream, they're very active and highly active. And they're fabulous activists and effective activists. And so is the Farm Workers Union, and so is MALDEF, Mexican American Legal Defense Fund. So there's a lot of new positive changes taking place, as well as other multi-agency nationwide coalitions, like the there's a Hispanic Leadership Coalition also, and many more. So there's a lot of good things that are positive and large and coalition centered that are taking place for the betterment and good of Latinos and Latinas and the working class and all of us in the United States. At the same time, as you just mentioned, you know, some things have apparently not changed. And this is something that Cesar Chavez, Dolores Huerta, the Filipino workers unions worked for to change. The living conditions, the wages, the promotion, the abuses and the pesticides, all those things. It's something we all need to be more aware of and need to voice ourselves regarding what's going on. Otherwise, it will continue. It will stay in motion, and because it's not mentioned on the channels and in the media at large, it doesn't mean it's not taking place. So we are the new media.
And I think maybe, do you feel a part of your poetry is activism in the sense of shedding a light on those conditions?
That I believe in that. You know, I believe in humanity, and I believe in social change for the better of everyone, you know, all colors, all classes. And I dedicate my life towards that. I also do, you know, experimental poetry, of course, and that's good. And experimental art, of course, that's good. And that's, it's kind of the same thing, because I orient it all. I orient my life towards humanity, and that's a good thing, especially today.
Well, and I think you have such an interesting perspective. I wanted to ask you, when we think about your performance art, your poetry, your activism, you've been at the University of Illinois visiting the Department of Latina and Latino Studies. And I don't know if you're aware, the department made the front page of the newspaper recently because written on chalk on the sidewalk surrounding the building were quotes, "They must go back and build the wall." And, you know, we had students in Michigan who called the police when they saw similar messages on their college campuses. Where do you think free speech fits into this line of people saying, I wonder where you think the line is between free speech and hate speech and what people have a responsibility to do, especially on a college campus?
You know, well, you know, that line needs to be considered by all of us, you know, because that line can be stretched. Of course, it's free speech. However, we must speak up and we feel that free speech is hate speech, as opposed to just letting it be this generic free speech. You know, if we are disrespecting, if we are abusing, if we are using violent language, which that is, then we need to notice it, speak up, and change it. Otherwise, once again, we leave things the way they are, they will stay the way they are, and many people will be, abused and disrespected and experience, violent actions, which is language can be that.
I'm speaking with Juan Felipe Herrera. When we come back, we're going to continue our conversation about poetry, about activism, about all this stuff. Maybe you'll read a poem for us as well?
For sure.
All right, stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo.
The 21st is made possible by Custer & Bradley, LLP, providing legal service to the Urbana-Champaign community since 1895. Custer & Bradley's attorneys are committed to achieving the best results for their clients. More information is available at CusterLawLLP.com.
Welcome back to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. My guest in studio with me, the Poet Laureate of the United States, Juan Felipe Herrera. He has been in town because he was doing a book signing, his latest work, Notes on the Assemblage. We're in studio talking about his life, his work, his activism. Would you read a poem for us? Do you have one ready there? I see you're flipping through. Okay, you can keep looking unless you've got one ready.
It's called Border Bus. And this is a bus that really is a border bus. It's filled with people, especially women, that have been detained at the border for not having papers. And they're put in this bus, and they're being taken. This bus is going, you know, to a particular city in Southern California to be put in holding cells there, a detention center in that particular city. And the people of that city come out and don't want this border bus in their town. So they are protesting and they are blocking the entrance of the border bus. So that's what this piece is. I'm very concerned about it. I'm very concerned about that, about the experience of people being detained. I'm very concerned about the whole thing about not having papers and how people are perceived that cross the border and the condition their lives are in. ¿A dónde vamos? Where are we going? Speak in English or the guard is going to come. ¿A dónde vamos? Where are we going? Speak in English or the guard is going to get us, hermana. ¿Pero qué hicimos? But what did we do? Speak in English. Come on. No más unas pocas palabras. I just know a few words. You better figure it out, hermana. The guard is right there. See the bus driver? Tantos días y ni sabíamos para dónde íbamos. So many days and we didn't even know where we were headed. I know where we're going. Where we always go, to some detention center, to some fingerprinting hall or cube, some warehouse, warehouse after warehouse. Pero ya nos investigaron. Ya cruzamos y ya nos cacharon. Los federales del bordo, ¿qué más quieren? But they already questioned us. We already crossed over. They already grabbed us at the Border Patrol. What more do they want? We're in the bus now. That is all.
That's Juan Felipe Herrera. He's the poet laureate of the United States, the first Latino poet, and that's called Border Bus.
Border Bus.
How much time do you spend talking with women who have gone on these buses, talking to these families? I wonder how much of that came from you hearing stories from people.
It came from me hearing stories from people. Of course, you know, my mother and I traveled in buses, and my mother and I were questioned for papers when we got off the bus. My aunt.
Do you remember that?
I remember that.
Were you scared?
I didn't know what it was. I was scared. I didn't know what it was. Yes,
how old
I was.
Were you then?
Oh, you know, I was a kid, 7, 8.
Okay.
7, 8. Even younger than that, when I was 5, I saw my friends across. My father used to work for La Familia Garcia in Escondido, California. A little tiny plot of land with some corn. And he planted corn there and made a little crop for them happen because he was a campesino, a farm worker all his life since he was a kid. And somehow they owned this little plot of land, Mexicanos, and this little house they lived on. And then one day the Border Patrol came and took them one by one. So I was 5 years old. And my whole family, of course, has this experience. Told in not dire, gloomy voice, told in a voice of, this is our experience.
This is your family's story.
This is my family's story.
Yeah.
And, of course, I see children on the road here as a poet laureate and audiences. And they say, question and answer time, Q&A time, and they raise their hand, 11-year-old. I said, yes. He goes, I want to know how to write a story. Oh, okay. Well, I said, maybe you can tell me what kind of story you're writing and I can be more focused. He goes, well, you know, I'm writing a story about children that are abandoned because their parents were deported. I wasn't expecting that. And then I said, well, why don't you come up to the stage with me and tell us more about yourself? Because I felt that this 11-year-old boy needed to have a forum to present who he was and what he wanted to speak about and write about.
Did you start writing as a way to share your story?
I started writing because I got so curious about it. You know, when you're so young, you don't really think about a cause. I was just so young, you know, I was...
You were thinking, I need to express myself. You just wanted to write. You needed to write. Did you?
I probably did, you know. My teacher started talking about making sentences in eighth grade. My mother always told stories and sang out poems and performed in the trailer.
When you were traveling?
When I was a kid, yeah, as we traveled, because she had wanted to be a theater artist, but she was taken out of school in third grade. She came from the hardest times you can imagine after the Mexican Revolution and across the border. So she had this great love of knowledge and of art. So I kind of had her electricity. She kind of shot out that electricity at me, just physically.
Oh, well, it sounds like all of that creative energy as well, right?
Yeah.
I wanted to ask you, because as we're reading, as you were reading Border Bus, it's in English and Spanish. And I wonder how... in terms of how your brain works being bilingual for writing poetry, because I think I'm not bilingual, but my Spanish is good enough. And I think when you speak enough of another language, there are certain words, like I was thinking, like the word chisme, it just sounds so much better than saying gossip, right? You just say chisme. And I think that's something probably everybody who grows up in Miami uses that word a lot. Is that how it works for you? Or there are certain words you just think this needs to be in Spanish, or this phrase needs to be in Spanish, or this has to be in English?
You're right. You know, the words to me are like musical instruments. And each word for me is like a set of notes. It's like when the word chisme has that S and Z sound, and that CH, chisme, and it has an M in it, and it has a great sound.
It's a great word to say.
It's a great word to say. And ojalata is another great word, a tin, like, you know, that you, a tin plate or a sheet of tin. Ojalata. Because I'm bilingual, to me, it's actually one language now. It's one language with Spanish, English, and different kinds of Spanish and different kinds of English, and a whole multitude of a whole Fort Knox or Fort Chicharron or Fort Cilantro.
But it's
of
also
words.
But it's also for you. It sounds like it's the rhythm and the sound of the words in a way. It's much more a musical thing as well.
It is. It's rhythms and sounds
as opposed to necessarily the meaning. But I guess it's all of that, right?
Of course, as opposed to the meaning. Sometimes I push the meaning forward. And sometimes I push the sounds and images forward. And it's not a big old conscious kind of planning, strategic blueprint. But it kind of happens naturally in my mind and in my body. I go, yeah, you know, ooh, I'm going to write this one in Spanish. Wow, yeah, I can feel it. I can see it. I'm going to use a lot of animals and witches. And, you know, I'm going to get, this is going to be like a curandera, like a healer poem in Spanish. And then I'll go and I'll have, I'll kind of know what words I'm going to use without knowing them, because I'm going to bring in words like lagarto, like lizard.
Well, it's such an interesting thing with languages. You're talking about this because I'm thinking that's how language has, especially between Spanish and English, evolved in the U.S. If you think, because I say to people, I speak Spanglish fluently. And people ask me, I say, well, I speak Spanglish, yeah. If you really want to know. And that is a really interesting way to think about how a lot of communication is happening now.
You know, that's how it happens. As a matter of fact, as of right now, you're hereby pronounced a hardcore Chicana.
Great, thank you.
In addition to your other identities. You know, that's how it is. All languages are ish. All languages are ish languages. You know, English has a billion roots and a billion languages. You know, Germanic and Latin and on. And even Nahuatl, even Aztec, like the word chocolate. Comes from chocolatl, and that's an Aztec bona fide Mesoamerican term. It's not an English term, but it's become an English term, which is fabulous, but it actually has Aztec roots. So everything is ish.
What's your writing process like for you? Do you write every day? Is it you do?
I write every day. As soon as I see a piece of paper or an interesting looking pen like this Micron 2, I go, I like the pen. Oh, I just can't wait to write with it. Or I like the color.
So you write by hand.
I write by hand also. I'm kind of I used to be like 60-10, all right. Like a 90% time on the computer.
Okay.
And then 10% on journal. And now I've become like 80% on journal and 20% on the computer. But if it's a book that I'm working on, I got to go to the computer because it'll save it and it's legible. Because since I like to draw and use colors and scribble, I believe in I'm a scribble believer.
you should put a book out of that.
I am. It's called Jabberwocking.
Okay.
It's called Jabberwocking. How to write a fast poem in a fast world.
That's great. Uh-huh. I'm speaking with Juan Felipe Herrera. He's the poet laureate of the United States. And I have to ask you a question, especially as we were talking about, or before the break, we were talking about making a living. And I don't know if you know this. Do you know when you Google poet laureates, one of the top searches is how much money does a poet laureate make? And then, so of course, because it auto-filled that for me, I wanted to know how much you make, and I looked it up as a poet laureate. I'm sure you have a lot of positions.
It's a lot of money, let me tell you.
Can you tell everybody how much it is?
It's an incredible amount of money. It's around $35,000
a year. $35,000 a year for a stipend, I think is what they call it.
It's a stipend.
Which I think is a much more appropriate way to say than a salary. For the poet laureate of the United States.
It pays travel. It's travel and hotel money. And it only goes so far. Hotels are so expensive.
How hard is it to make a living as a poet if you're the poet laureate of the United States? And
if you start thinking about it, you're not going to get there. You know, all my life I've been writing poetry and expanding it into theater and performance and community, working with communities and farm workers and farm worker children and migrant communities and students and children, gifted classes, so-called not gifted classes. Diabetes workshops, poems, workshops for women, et cetera, which I love to do, all of those. So I never thought about if I was going to make a living. I thought about what good can I do for people and how I can encourage them to tell their story and to get into writing. And women that cross the border thousands of miles south of the border and made it to the United States and finally got into a writing project at the Austin Learning Academy, for example, where I taught online and in person. And I didn't think I was going to learn, teach at in that space, but it came to me because I've been writing a while and bilingual. And someone says, do you want to do this? I go, of course I do. So there I was. And of course I got paid for that. It wasn't a lot of money, but it helped me take care of bills. So it's all these stepping stones. You know, you have to step on one stone to get to the next one.
As you say that, Stepping Stones, I wanted to play this project I was telling you we were part of. It's called Redream. And it's talking about how the American dream has changed. And I think a lot of our conversation has kind of touched on this. I wanted you to hear these stories and get your reaction to them.
The American dream. White picket fences. 2.78 kids and a dog. It's a dream we once shared. What is success to you? What dreams do you chase?
To work a job that's going to make a difference in somebody else's life.
For many, higher education means social mobility.
People can come from anywhere, and if you're willing to work hard enough, you can have it all.
But there are still people that are left behind for a lot of different reasons. There's room, a lot of room for improvement across the board.
That's part of the Redream Project, which is a collection of videos of stories all across America of people sharing their dream. And I think as you listen to that, we have so much of a myth of if you work hard enough, you can accomplish your American dream. Do you think that's the case in this country today?
Well, you know, it's good to have dreams. And I support everybody on this project and everyone who wants to better the lives of others and their lives and the lives of their families. That's very important. That's beautiful. At the same time, you know, let us also think about all people should have abundant resources so that their dream is not limited to just resources. You know, they should be available. School should be available. Preschool should be available. Toddler resources should be available. Resources for women and childcare should be available. Insurance and counseling, education should be available so that they don't have to be the dreams. You know, I'm kind of pointing to something kind of odd. I'm just saying that all this should be available. These dreams already should be in place.
That shouldn't be a dream. That should be a reality.
That should be
saying.
A reality, you know. But it's good that it's a dream also, you know. Everything is fine. Everything's positive. Let's have those dreams to attain those resources. At the same time, let us be aware that to keep people without resources and have them struggling their whole life just to have resources and not really be able to be like my mom who never had a chance to be a singer because she was kind of trapped in a world without resources.
And we started this conversation with you talking about your parents coming here and working as migrant workers for your dream. And you have gone from that to being the poet laureate of the United States, the first Latino poet laureate of the United States. Do you feel like you've reached your American dream? Do you think?
Well, you know, my dream is for others. My dream is for others. I'm here because so many people brought me here. If it would have been just myself, I would probably be eating just a quesadilla on 14th and C Street in San Diego, where I used to have an apartment. We used to live in a small apartment. I probably would be there. I'd probably be doing art. That'd be great. But many people have brought me here. Of course, my parents, how hard they worked, and all the mentors I've had, friends that I've had, artists that I've known, teachers that I've known, people in arts communities and institutions that have supported me, and on, you know, yourself and people in radio and media that have given me a chance to speak on programs and newspapers who covered what I'm doing or were interested in me. And even when I was a little half taco, when I was just, you know, a Johnny poet, when I was Juanito poet, and they would invite me to a show and ask me good, cool questions. And so all those people brought me here to this table with you, and you are taking me further as well. So I thank you, and I thank everyone. But my dream is for others, and people have brought me here in many numbers. I thank all of them.
Well, thank you for sharing with us. That's Juan Felipe Herrera. He's the Poet Laureate of the United States. His latest book is called Notes on the Assemblage. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you. Thank you, Nayla.
The 21st is made possible by the Library at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, fostering discovery by providing information, curation, and archival services to extend scholarly impact from Urbana-Champaign to the state, the nation, and the world. The University Library at Illinois.
Aboard the International Space Station, a crew of astronauts from around the globe capture the wonders of our world as few can. From this unique vantage point, we gain insight into the impact we have on the environment and witness what humankind can accomplish when we work together.
The arrival to the space station was possibly the happiest moment of my life.
That was a pretty wild ride.
Looking at Earth from space, we need to start to consider ourselves more as crew members, not passengers.
You're listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo, and that was a clip from the new IMAX movie, A Beautiful Planet. It opened actually just a few minutes ago at the Savoy IMAX Theater. It's also playing in Chicago at the IMAX Theater there. A Beautiful Planet wouldn't have been created without the Advanced Visualization Laboratory at the University of Illinois. The team at AVL is all about scientific storytelling. They're really the only team like it in the world. And two people from that team are with me in studio now. AJ Christensen is a visualization programmer. Stuart Levy is a senior research programmer. Welcome. Thanks for being here, guys.
Hey, thank you
for inviting us.
I wanted to start by asking you, what does the AVL actually do?
Well, one way to say it is we take different sorts of science data, sometimes from physical simulations or sometimes from observed data or sometimes from, you know, advice from scientists, and make pretty pictures out of it for public outreach. So other people take science data and make visualizations of it for the scientists to use or for the scientists to communicate with other scientists. But one of the things that we focus on is making things to bring the public to places where people can't go, or to understand things that you wouldn't see otherwise.
And so, Stuart, that happens with educational films, that happens with, and I don't know what category, with documentaries like A Beautiful Planet. AJ, I don't know what category you would put that in. But AJ, I wanted to ask you, what other films, you guys, both of you, have worked on different, like a variety of different films, not just educational ones, but for Hollywood. And for everybody who was wondering who that voice, I should say that's Jennifer Lawrence, if you were trying to figure out who that was voicing that. AJ, what other films have you worked on?
So just a little bit of context before I say that. We work a lot with sort of Hollywood standard visual effects tools and sort of bend them to our will in terms of making scientific visuals. We typically work on a lot of documentaries that have celebrity narrators, but it also equips us to do things for bigger, more Hollywood productions. And so I actually took a leave of absence from the university a couple years ago to work on the film Interstellar.
We actually have a clip of Interstellar, and it's part of the scene that you worked specifically on. Let's play a little bit of that, and then we'll talk about it. I've been waiting for
this moment to come out. The best part about being an astronaut is looking back at our home planet. Especially at night, the cities are
looks
so
like
bright.
Sorry, that's actually doesn't look like that's actually the right clip. Sorry about that. But it was the scene in Interstellar where there's the black hole, where Matthew McConaughey is going into the black hole. And we'll see if we can get that. We can play it. But you worked on that black hole. How did that come about? How long did it take, first of all, to figure out the black hole?
Yeah, so that was a really interesting situation in Hollywood too, because I think Hollywood is sort of slowly starting to pick up a lot of the things that Donna and Bob and Stuart have known for years and years, long before I was even on the scene. Which is that using like real science math and real data that's been created by scientists, you can create really beautiful things that are not lies. and so for Interstellar, it was really cool. They actually this was the R&D team. This wasn't me. I just got to use the tool they created. But the tool basically was doing gravitational lensing, which is something that we've observed looking at black holes through telescopes. But up until then, had really not featured in any Hollywood film. And it was a graphical challenge and a really cool one. We were basically able to sort of create a new visual paradigm.
Is it hard to do that? Do you all get pushback where it ends up being a much more difficult thing? Like, it sounds like, for me, I'm like, why can't you just create a black hole that looks like a black hole? But I imagine it's a lot harder than that.
Right. So the interesting thing about black holes is that as very massive objects with strong gravity, they actually affect photons. They affect light. The light is sort of pulled toward them. And if they have enough gravity, the light can actually get trapped in the black hole, which is actually why it's called a black hole. But if the light doesn't get trapped, it can be bent. And so you actually, it's just like holding a lens over an image, and everything starts to sort of bubble out, and you get this.
Which you actually do start seeing. So you see some of that in Interstellar for people who have seen it.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And actually, Kip Thorne is a sort of renowned astrophysicist, and he was the science advisor on that film. And, you know, kudos to Interstellar for having a science advisor at all. Especially one like Kip.
And I wanted, Stuart, I wanted to ask you about that as well, because I know you've done a few scenes. You did a few scenes for Terrence Malick in The Tree of Life. Have either of you had pushback when you, because you all do, the AVL does a lot of work with different Hollywood teams. And I wonder, do you feel like there's more of a trend now to having scientific advisors and making it more realistic? Is that much more of an important part of Hollywood culture, whether it's something like The Martian? I think people talked a lot about how a lot of the science of that was accurate, or what you all do with the visual depictions of how it actually looks.
You know, I would love to know what they did behind the scenes in thinking about The Martian and thinking through what they would. So I don't know anything about that. For Tree of Life, the director wanted it to look. He didn't want it to look like computer graphics, even though, of course, it was. He wanted it to look as though you might be seeing it with your eyes somehow. But he was very particular about not wanting just sort of any nice visual effect for these particular pieces. So one of the pieces that we worked on was following the explosions of the first generation of stars in the universe. And I don't know why he picked those. I have a guess that they're... You could kind of say, given the understanding of physics and the history of star formation, you know, sort of on the deaths of these first stars depended the life of everything that comes after them, including people.
So that's why he picked it.
Well, I don't. Okay. Yeah, I mean, I don't know that, but so he was very particular about wanting this specific simulation to show up in the film. As for having science advisors with Hollywood films, that's an interesting question.
AJ, do you think that there's more of a trend to having it be more real or more accurate now that especially with you all having the supercomputing ability to actually visualize this?
Yeah, I mean, I've been reading a lot in just sort of the cinema news that talks about how there's a new organization. I can't tell you the name of it, but it's an organization of scientists that are so committed to having the science in film and television real that they are volunteering their time on science and television projects so that they can actually get that in there. One other sort of interesting example I can come up with off the top of my head is Pixar's The Good Dinosaur. They actually, their story is interesting because they had a kind of a crunched time window in order to finish the film, and they found out that a way to speed up their process was to use real U.S. Geological Survey data to create their environments. And so I think like Hollywood is starting to pick up the things that we've been doing for a while now.
And what's the difference between CGI and what you all do in terms of visualization?
Well, let's see.
Or would you say you do both?
To some extent, we do both. I mean, one thing you might imagine that we could do, but I think it would be unfair to say it, is that we would make, you know, somehow photorealistic versions of the scenes that we're in, and that I think that's really mostly not what we do. You know, we're using the science. Usually, the science will only cover part of the knowledge available from us from science or from a physical simulation will only cover part of what we need to do. What we need to do is to tell a story, and we want it to be guided by the science in important ways. You know, we don't just want it to look pretty, even though we do want it to look pretty. So for example, in A Beautiful Planet, AJ made. Can I talk about your solar system?
Sure. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, a system of planets around another star.
How did you make that, AJ?
Like you were asking, it's a combination of the visual effects techniques and the science. So the planetary system is called K186, and it's centered around a star that was found by the Kepler telescope mission. And the way that that telescope mission worked, they were looking for exoplanets, planets around other stars. And they noticed slight flickers in the brightness of the stars that they were looking at, and that was an indication that a planet was passing in front of them. And, you know, this change in brightness, Stuart can probably tell you, is maybe like...
Oh, I don't know, a fraction of a percent.
Okay, so pretty minimal.
Very small, right. Yes. Yeah.
And so how did you use those changes in brightness to help visualize everything? So that's what you actually saw in the telescope.
Right, so that's what the telescope shows us. And from that, scientists are able to conclude, they know how many times, you know, how frequently the planet passes in front of that star. And so you can tell how far away from the star the planet is and how fast it's traveling in its orbit.
And how big it is.
And how big the planet is. And so those are the kinds of data then that we were able to put into our visual effects scene. And then it was a process of you know, creating a very carefully choreographed camera path flying, you know, light years?
Oh, yeah, 500 light years or so.
just 500 light years or so. Okay.
Yeah. which, by the way, is like a big challenge. One of the things that Hollywood tends to not do is tackle hard challenges head on. They just kind of work their way around them. But because we were trying to be really faithful to the data, we actually flew through the real spatial relationship.
And this is in a beautiful planet.
This is for a beautiful planet, okay. Yeah, as we approach this this K186 planetary system.
So when you're watching a beautiful planet, how would you describe it to a viewer in terms of the accuracy of what they're seeing as they're kind of going through that?
Could I speak to that?
Mm-hmm.
So this is one of the places where we sort of stretch the truth in order to make a visual point. So the relative sizes of the planets are right, and their relative distances from the star compared to each other are right. But the planets are much, much bigger compared to the spaces between them than they are in real life. So like, you know, in Earth's sky, when you look at, you know, Venus and Jupiter and so forth, which you can see in the sky these days, they're dots. So generally, the planets are tiny and the spaces between them are enormous. But if all you saw was like one planet and a bunch of little bright dots, nobody would understand what you were seeing. And so we were paying attention to the truth, but we also needed to tell a story. And so we stretched the truth.
And let me ask you then, what do you all see as the mission of AVL? Is it to educate? Is it to entertain, maybe, may not be the right word you guys would use, but what do you see the mission of? And when you're doing your visualizations, does it kind of shift a little bit? Or
I think Stuart hit on this earlier when he said that what we're trying to do is tell a story. So the goal, of course, with, you know, being a part of the university system is to educate and reach out to the public. But one of the most tried and true ways to do that is to tell a story, and so that's what differentiates us from a lot of people who make scientific imagery, is that we're specifically making scientific imagery for the general public.
And how do you think, we just have about a minute left, but I just want to ask how you think virtual reality has changed? Like, are you guys excited? Oh, both of you are nodding. Are you both excited about doing sort of a virtual reality version of what you all have been doing so far just in IMAX?
Oh, how interesting. I mean, there have been so many generations of virtual reality, right? So
I'm thinking like a Google Glass version now,
yes,
you know, that's
right.
Sort of a little bit more available.
They used to be $1 million systems that you could have, you know, one or two of them per state. And now anybody can have them.
Yeah. And we've been using virtual reality to pre-visualize our scenes for years and years now. That was actually a lot of how we created the flight through these data sets was using basically virtual reality.
Hmm. Well, so that would be cool. So maybe one day everyone could also, with their own virtual reality, see how you all are putting everything together.
Yeah.
That's
interesting. Okay. So that's these are two of the folks behind A Beautiful Planet, which just opened at the Savoy 16 IMAX Theater. It's also showing in Chicago if you check showtimes for that. AJ Christensen is a visualization programmer. Stuart Lee is a senior research programmer with the Advanced Visualization Laboratory at the University of Illinois. Thanks for being with me.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for inviting us.
That does it for us today on The 21st. We're produced by Christine Herman, Amanda Hunningfort, Austin Keating, and Travis Stansel. Technical direction comes from Jason Croft, with help today from Steve Mork. Scott Cameron is our news director. Special thanks to the Midwest band Public Access for the music we've been playing on the 21st. The album's called Public Access. You can always reach us. You can email us. You can give us a call. All of the information's on our website. Visit 21stshow.org. Thanks for listening. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Have a great weekend.